Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Melinda Himmelgarn. She is a registered dietitian, an investigative nutritionist, an award-winning writer, and the host of Food Sleuth Radio. And I'm so excited to have her on. I'll tell you more about her in just a bit when she does come on. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news, some ways that you can take action on issues that are so important, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. So as I've discussed over and over, week after week, you know, the current administration is really doing a number on so many things, from the Environmental Protection Agency to climate change to food, school lunches. Anyway, right now they're trying to ease rules on GMO crops. And, you know, I just was reading about some testing that they did on some wheat out in Washington State. And, you know, wheat is coming up with being genetically modified, even though wheat is not one of the crops that one thinks of as a genetically modified food. But they are really trying to overhaul the biotechnology rules, and they have came up with an acronym called SECURE, which would actually exempt many gene-edited organisms from regulation. And they're also allowing, they're proposing that the GMO developer, the companies can self-determine on their own whether the new traits qualify for exemption. And so again, it's, you know, it's like the fox guarding the chicken coop. It's just, it doesn't make sense. And we need people to speak out against that. So, you know, I actually don't have a link for this one right now, but I'm sure I will in the next couple of days. But keep your eyes open for anything, you know, when you see things coming across your inbox where you can sign your name or write a letter to oppose some of these horrible new regulations, please take action and, you know, do something about it. One of the actions that I do have on my newsletter this week is to let Congress know, your senators know, that you want them to uphold the commitments we made during the Paris Climate Agreement. You know, Trump is certainly trying to, you know, not stand up to those commitments that we made and to backpedal. And as someone who's really concerned about the environment and climate change, I think we all need to let our legislators know that we really care. And so I do have a letter on my website that you can click on to send to your senators to let them know that you want them to stand up against climate change and to uphold the commitments we made at the Paris Climate Agreement. These things might seem little, but if we don't all become political activists, the corporate money that's behind all of these big corporations is just going to take over. And so it's really important that we all let our voices be heard, because we do not have the kind of money that these big corporations have. But we do have the power of people power and the numbers of people to get behind these initiatives. So please, you know, find an issue that you really feel passionate about and take some action, and we'll all be in a better place. Some things I want to share with you that are coming up in the New York area. Some of the things actually are more in the country, like the Slow Food Nation, that I'll tell you about in a bit. But there's lots of great things coming up in this area. This weekend, on June 15th, Edible and Medicinal Herb Walk with the natural nurse Ellen Kamai. Ellen Kamai is also a radio host on the Progressive Radio Network. She's a wealth of information when it comes to herbology and medicinal remedies. And I've gone on these edible and medicinal walks with her before, and she's just great. This one's going to be at Restoration Farm, which is one of our local organic farms, on June 15th from 1 to 2:30. So check that out. Seacliff Farmers Market is opening on June 15th, as most of the farmers markets are starting to open. I know the one in Port Washington just opened. Farmers markets, as you all know, is a great way to get your vegetables in season, fresh when they're picked. Just, you know, get to know your farmer. You know that I have talked to you many times before about organic versus non-organic. Many growers, many farmers might not be certified organic, but they follow organic principles. They don't spray and their food is really great. They just don't participate in the organic program. And that's just fine. But just because a farmer is at a farmer's market doesn't mean that they don't spray. So you do want to know the difference. So just ask the farmer. I don't know a farmer. I have not met a farmer that really lies. If they spray, they are happy to say that they spray. So just ask. But farmers markets are a great way to get your vegetables. Also, community supported agriculture, CSAs. If you have not looked into that, that's another wonderful way of getting fresh weekly vegetables at a very reasonable, fair price. So community supported agriculture is wonderful. You can go onto a website called localharvest.org. They have a great list of community supported agricultural things. Also, just Google it in your local area. Most local papers write about community supported agriculture. We had a fair at the beginning of April where you could come and meet all the farmers that were growing the vegetables. And it's just a wonderful way of dealing directly with the farmers. On June 17th, Local Roots is having a healthy happy hour at Agritecture in the city. Celebrate National Eat Your Veggies Day with a healthy happy hour. Tickets are only $10. That should be fun. Local Roots is a CSA. I had Wen Jay on my radio show a couple of months ago, and actually bought a CSA membership for my son for his birthday through Local Roots, and he was very happy. So, you know, again, with CSAs, there's so many different ones. Many of them have add-ons. One of the things I liked about Local Roots is that I could add on for my son, you know, organic eggs, grass-fed meat. You know, some have local sustainable fish. So you really want to check out the CSA and see if the CSA that you're looking at has some of those features that you're looking for. What else? There's an herbal medicine making class also with the natural nurse on June 23rd, also at Restoration Farm, that you might be interested in going to. Slow Food East End is having a Eight Hands Farm tour and food truck tasting. Eight Hands Farm is the farm out east where we purchased organic lamb for our slow food event a few months ago. We served a lamb meatball, and you know, they're a really great farm, all grass fed, and they're in Catchogue out on the east end. So they will also have food trucks there for a variety of tastings, and there's only 40 spots available. So if you're interested in going, it's being hosted by Slow Food East End. Slow Food Nations is a big event taking place in Denver, July 19th to the 22nd. And that's a free event. There's lots of different things going on that where you can buy tickets that are extras. But there's lots of you know, street fairs and parties and talks and lectures. So if you are in the Denver area or taking a trip out that way or want to make a special trip, I went 2 years ago and it was really a wonderful event. The Cloud Institute is having their annual sustainability curriculum design studio tour at Omega Institute in Rhinebeck. That's something worth checking out. NOFA is having their summer conference. NOFA is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And every state has their own chapter. I am on the board of the New York State chapter, but in the summertime, all the NOFAs in the Northeast get together and have a big conference. And this one will be taking place in Amherst the weekend of August 9th through the 11th. And the theme is Nutrition Matters, Soil Health Builds Human Health. And we've been seeing so much about that in the news. Maybe that will even come up in my conversation with my guest today, but you know, soil health and your digestive system is connected. You know, the nutrients in the soil affect the health of the plants, and your intestines and your digestive system affects your overall health as well. So it's amazing how connected that is. And then August 23rd, NOFA New York is having their gala, and we're asking everyone to come on out and support organic food and farmers, human health, and the well-being of the planet at the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York's Climate of Change Gala. And this is going to take place on Friday, August 23rd from 7 to 11 p.m. at Locust Grove Estate in Poughkeepsie. And the Climate of Change Gala will be an evening of inspiring speakers, a farm-to-table dinner, open bar, and silent and live auctions to support the organization's programming for organic farmers and consumers in New York State. We have a great speaker, organic farmer, actress, and filmmaker Isabella Rossellini is our guest speaker. And Scott Chasky, poet, farmer, and educator at the Peconic Land Trust, will be the master of ceremonies. So check out the NOFANewYork.org website for more information on that. And now I'm excited to share with you the recipe that I created Monday evening. It's a saffron vegetable casserole. And I had just come back from the West Coast, and I didn't have a lot in my refrigerator. But what I had, I turned into this great casserole, and I want to share it with you. So saffron vegetable casserole, these are the ingredients first. A quarter cup of boiling water, 1 teaspoon of saffron threads, 1/2 cake of tofu. You're actually going to use a whole cake, but I separated it because one part is being used for the sauce and one part is being used inside the casserole. So 1/2 cake of tofu that you're going to slice thin, 1/4 cup of nutritional yeast, and 1 teaspoon of curry powder and 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon coconut oil, splash of tamari, 2 cups of cauliflower florets sliced so that they're about 1/4 inch thick, 1 tablespoon of virgin coconut oil, 1 medium onion sliced into slivers, 1 orange pepper cut into strips, 2 cups fresh spinach chopped, 2 tablespoons fresh cilantro, 1.5 pounds of small red potatoes sliced, salt and fresh pepper ground, 1/2 cake of tofu, 1 cup of coconut milk, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon curry powder, and 2 tablespoons of chopped cilantro again. And so I started by, in a Pyrex cup, I poured 1/4 cup of boiling water over the saffron threads and just set those aside and let that come to room temperature. Meanwhile, in a pie pan, I wanted to make a breading for the tofu. So I combined the nutritional yeast with the curry powder and the salt. And then I breaded the tofu cutlets on both sides with the nutritional yeast. And I slowly sauteed them so that they would get really crispy in the 1 tablespoon of coconut oil until they were golden brown. You really could use any oil that you have that you're comfortable with. I just happen to have the coconut oil there. Once they're golden brown and crispy, you splash them with a little bit of the tamari, and that just sears them and locks in a little bit of saltiness so that it's a little bit like a vegetarian bacon almost into the casserole. So I laid the potato slices out on a cookie sheet that I covered the cookie sheet with some parchment paper, and I sprayed the parchment paper with a little bit of olive oil. And then I laid all the potato slices out. I sprinkled a little salt and pepper on the potato, and I baked the potato slices at a 400-degree oven for about 10 to 15 minutes until they got soft. I didn't want to depend on them cooking all the way through in the casserole, so I wanted to pre-cook them a little bit. And then in the same saute pan that I used for the tofu, I added 1 tablespoon of coconut oil, and I sauteed the onion slivers until they were soft and translucent. Then I added the orange pepper and sauteed those for about 5 minutes just so they got soft. I sprayed the bottom of a casserole pan with oil, and I covered the bottom of the casserole pan with 1/2 of the potato slices. Then I put in 1/2 of the onions and peppers and spread those out evenly over the potatoes. I sprinkled a couple tablespoons of the cilantro over the casserole at that point. Then I added the chopped spinach and spread that out evenly over the onions and peppers. Then I added the cauliflower slices and spread that out over the spinach. And the spinach and the cauliflower are soft enough, they cooked right in the casserole. I didn't have to pre-cook them at all. The tofu slices, the cutlets, I piled those together and just chopped them a little bit so that they were smaller pieces. And I spread those pieces out evenly over the casserole. And then I added the remaining onions and peppers and spread them out. Then I covered the whole casserole with the remaining half of the potato slices. And I layered them in a nice little pattern over the top. Then in a food processor, I made a sauce with the remaining half cake of tofu, the saffron water and threads, the 1 cup of coconut milk, the 1/4 teaspoon of salt, and the 1/2 teaspoon of curry powder. And I pulsed that in the food processor until I had this beautiful orange smooth sauce. It almost looked like those cheese sauces that they put on nachos that is usually garbage. But this was really delicious. And I poured that mixture over the whole casserole, spread it out evenly with a spatula, and then I baked it at 375 for about 40 minutes until the top kind of set and the whole casserole was cooked. I removed it from the oven, let it sit just for a few minutes. I garnished it with some fresh cilantro, and voila, that was it. It was so good and delicious, and I highly recommend you all giving it a try. I know it sounds a little complicated, but it really was not. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Linda Himmelgarn is a registered dietitian, investigative nutritionist, award-winning writer, and radio host. She has 35 years experience in clinical, academic, and public health nutrition, and she's a trusted consumer advocate and an engaging and energizing national speaker. For 20 years, Melinda wrote a weekly trademarked food sleuth newspaper column for Columbia, Missouri, Daily Tribune. And she published articles in the Today's Dietitian, Natural Awakenings, Acres, Edible Community magazines as well. And prior to her freelance writing, speaking, and radio career, Melinda developed and directed the Nutrition Communication Center at the University of Missouri. In 2004, she received a Food and Society Policy Fellowship, which allowed her to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture. And today she's uniquely applies those critical thinking skills to media messages about food and farm policy, to talk about food system literacy and to really advance that whole concept of food system literacy. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, Melinda. Melinda, you with me?
Hi, I am. It's great to be with you. You're making me hungry with that recipe.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, well, it's really good. I recommend giving it a shot. But I wanted to ask you, before I get into all my questions, if you could just backtrack a little and tell us a little bit more about your history. How did you first get interested in nutrition? What inspired you to become a dietitian?
Yeah, you know, I had no intention of being a dietitian. I wanted to be an art major. And I was actually...
That's so funny. I was an art major also.
Well, there are a lot of connections, aren't there, between the art world and the food world. And so it's wonderful to be able to blend those together. But I was in the textile design program at Florida State University. And that particular program was in the College of Home Economics because that's where textile was. And part of the requirement to be in the College of Home Economics was that you had to take a class in every other field of expertise that goes under that umbrella of home economics. So, you know, I took child development and I took consumer economics and then I took a nutrition course and I fell in love and I've never looked back. I changed my major. I have been in love with the subject for over 35 years. And it's just really grown as I've gone through different iterations of diet and nutrition work. You know, doing my Food and Society Policy Fellowship was a real eye-opener because I don't know about you and your background, but I never studied agriculture when I was a dietitian. I think things are changing a bit, but this is a big gap in our education. And so we need, I think, to come out of our silos and cross-pollinate a little bit so that people in agriculture learn from people who are studying human nutrition, and people in medical school are studying human nutrition and agriculture, so that we can all work together for certainly a healthier planet and people.
You're so right. You're so right. It was funny when we first met, even virtually first met before we actually met. It was actually around the food conference that I was organizing, and you had reached out to me because you noticed that we didn't have a dietitian on any of our panels, and you were curious as to why. And I had shared with you that, for me, most of my experience with dietitians, they hadn't cross-pollinated yet. You were dietitians that had come out of school where they did not really learn that much about nutrition or agriculture or what I consider healthy food. And, I always thought of dietitians as the people responsible for our school lunch program and our institutional food programs. And for the most part, that's where they come from. And if you look at our school food and our institutional food, they're pretty lousy. So I wasn't, and I was so, so happy to have the conversation with you and learn that there's a whole bunch of dietitians out there and nutritionists out there that are really changing the arena of dietitians and the, and the perception that I had on that. So you want to talk a little bit about that and the organization that you're a part of that is changing that?
Absolutely. And, I think that you are not alone. Let me just say that. I remember years ago writing an article for Natural Awakenings magazine, and my publisher got back with me, and she said, I received this letter from a reader wondering why I would have a registered dietitian write for me when all the dietitians are in bed with industry. And I spent a couple of hours responding to the reader and explaining, what our training was. And it's so unfortunate that there are these perceptions. Do some dietitians work for the food industry? Yes, there are dietitians who work for Coca-Cola. There are dietitians who work for McDonald's. I can tell you that in my experience, we all go through school with the intention, with the best of intentions, to improve public health. I think we all, I got to speak for all of my fellow dietitians, but we got into this work because we see food as medicine. But we are victims of our educational system. And, nothing is obvious to the uninformed. And my first job out of my dietetic internship was actually at a veterans hospital, where I saw the intersection of poverty and the ravages of war, and what happens when someone is living in poverty and doesn't have access to healthy food, and then layer on top of that, all of the post-traumatic stress issues. So it was that experience in the hospital that led me to want to work in prevention, and that's when I ended up going back and getting my master's and working at the University of Missouri. And I had read an article that said that people get most of their education from the media and not from dietitians. Well, of course, that's true, right? So I decided that I needed to get into media. And I tried to learn as much as I could and to help my consumer or the listener understand the bigger system. But it wasn't until I did that fellowship that I really was able to connect the dots with agriculture. It is not part of our training. Things are changing, as I mentioned. There are many dietetic program directors now who incorporate sustainable agriculture in their work. But I also think it's really important for dietitians to have that original or initial work in a clinic or hospital setting so you can see the ravages of what poverty does to people and what poor diet does to people. It's so far beyond personal choice. We often victimize people for their food, quote-unquote, choices, when really many people are extremely limited to what they can eat.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you talk about that because I was in a wellness committee meeting just before this radio show today. I've taken on a position as the farm-to-school coordinator for a local public school that was awarded a New York State grant from Ag and Markets to bring more fruits and vegetables into the school lunch program. And And so I was in this meeting with them talking about the foods that are commodity foods that the school lunch program has to take or they lose their funding. Like, you know, and, you know, it is the food that we don't really, that if you have a choice, you're not going to choose to eat. It's, you know, the canned vegetables and the highly processed dairy products and, you know, just really crap food. And you have to work with that. And so, you know, there's this whole list of bid list, you know, they're part of a cooperative buying club for institutions on Long Island. And, you know, trying to go through this list and also the government commodity foods that you have to take and trying to find the most least offensive foods that you can take to meet your requirement. It's it's horrific.
These are policy issues. And in schools where the parents are educated and they have maybe time on their hands and they have resources, they can raise their voices and be stronger advocates than if you're working in a school where the kids are largely on free or reduced price lunch, the parents are working at least two jobs, maybe more, maybe single parents. It's hard to be an advocate when your basic needs have not been met. But years ago, I went to a wonderful conference. It was the Children's Environmental Health Network conference, and there was a woman who gave a talk on BPA in just all the exposures that kids get to bisphenol A, which is an endocrine disruptor. It's in the plastic linings of cans. It's in, you know, plastics. It's ubiquitous in so many plastics. Anyway, because so much of the school lunch is served on, you know, plastic trays, they're canned foods, maybe the kids, in some cases, there isn't even a kitchen at the school. This was my situation with my kids when they were in middle school, for crying out loud. No kitchen? Who designed this school? And the kids would get, like, food that was cooked at a central location and then brought in on styrofoam. So the kids that were, this particular session was on looking at blood levels of BPA in kids. And wouldn't you know, the kids that were super dependent on these school food services, they had higher levels of BPA because they had no other choice but to eat these processed foods that largely came in plastic packaging or canned. So we have a lot of work to do. As you mentioned earlier, you know, getting in touch with your legislators is really key. I wanted to just bring up Beyond Pesticides because there's always, there's a wonderful newsletter and there's a great, you know, call to arms, so to speak, for how people can get involved. But that's jumping back to something that you mentioned, you know, before we spoke together. But joining parents together, you know, being active in the parent-teacher organizations, if you can. And I realize that many parents absolutely can't because they are so distraught and economically disadvantaged. This is an economic issue, an economic injustice issue.
Yeah, economic issue. And as you said before, media issue, because so much media is targeted at these marginalized communities that are
absolutely
struggling. And they, you know, they really focus the advertising on the populations that really are in need. And it's tough.
That's right. And if, again, if you're one of those lucky children who gets to go to camp and gets to go to dance lessons and swim lessons, you're not going to have as much time sitting in front of a screen. But if you're if you're from a low-income community, many times those children spend more time with screen-based media. And we know, for example, that Hispanic and African Americans, not saying that all Hispanic and African Americans are of a lower socioeconomic standing, but if you look at who is exposed to more media messages for junk food, African American and Hispanic youth are exposed to more than white youth.
Right.
Another injustice.
Right. Yeah. And even socially, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who, you know, she's from Puerto Rico and her family, you know, it's culturally rude almost. Like they're inhospitable. If people come over and you don't have Coca-Cola and you don't have some of these drinks that I consider so bad for you. Culturally, they're looked at as being not welcoming if they don't offer them. It's really, really something.
Isn't that
interesting? So ingrained.
It's real interesting when you look at immigrant populations, and of course, my grandparents were immigrants, and so I think that there was this rejection of things in the old country and a love and acceptance of things in the new country without really knowing what some of those unintended consequences were of some of those new things. So, for example, breastfeeding versus formula feeding, right? Formula was seen as, oh, this is the modern way to go about feeding your infant, when we know that breastfeeding, of course, is the absolute best way if you can. With regard to Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. though, I think one thing that has been a really great way to teach kids just how they're being duped is, and we did this project, I was involved in a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant years ago, and we had kids measure out by teaspoons how much sugar was in a typical can or bottle of Coke. And they were blown away. And then what you can do with the kids then is have them make a more delicious, nutritious beverage. Like, let's say you make some lemonade. You can squeeze the lemons, show them how to squeeze them, and then add, a fraction of the sugar that would have been in the soft drink, or use a little bit of honey and mix that up, and then teach them how to make an alternative beverage. Kids tend not to like water so much. In fact, there's been good research on children who participate in sports. And another thing that you can do is take a fruit juice, and you can take a quarter cup of fruit juice and dilute it up to, a cup or a cup and a half with some plain filtered water, ideally, and add some ice, and it's a very refreshing beverage for kids who are participating in sports and need to drink a lot, especially in hot summer months. Again, getting away from those sports drinks. But I've had those battles with my own children. My son played on sports teams, and he wanted to, when it was my turn to bring the snacks, he wanted me to bring Gatorade. And it's like, nope, not going to do it because I love you. This is what we're going to do instead.
Right.
It's hard.
Right.
Really
I do that with
hard.
My kids all the time. I would make, we'd call them, bubble water. They like seltzer, and I put just a little bit of juice in with the seltzer, and it was, their soda.
Right, exactly. There are alternatives, and having kids in the kitchen, which is what you do so well, teaching people how to cook, this is a life skill. And I've taught my kids, I've taught them how to cook, just like I've given them lessons on how to swim. These are life skills, and if you don't know how to cook, you're going to have to depend on somebody else to do it for you, and they're never going to do it as well as you can do it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing I was talking about today in this wellness committee is, the district that I'm in, it's very a lot of immigrant Italian families and Latino families. But in the kitchen, predominantly Italian. I mean, I would feel like I'm, at a slow food conference in Italy, I mean, they're all talking Italian and I'm hearing them talk about recipes. They're such good cooks, and they would love the opportunity to do some of their cooking for these kids. And instead they're opening cans and measuring out canned fruit cocktail. It just doesn't make sense.
Oh, it's terrible.
That's the point that the kids are getting. And so, in the 6 weeks that I've been in this school, just I was like, well, why not bring in watermelon, fresh watermelon? That can't be that expensive. And you would have thought we were giving these kids gold. I mean, they couldn't believe that they were getting fresh watermelon in the school. They were coming back for seconds. They were so happy. It was just amazing. And then today I was like, they do salads at this school, but it's, romaine lettuce or iceberg lettuce, nothing. And I said, how about arugula salad, even though the pears that they have are canned, but I was like, do arugula salad with some fresh, with the canned pears. I said, I wanted fresh pears. She goes, well, can I do canned pears? That's what she had. I was like, okay. But, the kids love the arugula. It was amazing. And, so many people thought, oh, the kids aren't going to like arugula. They knew what it was, and they were welcoming it. So a lot of times people think kids aren't going to like stuff, and they just, you know, they underplay them.
When a school has a garden, this is exactly what happens. This is the magic of a garden. If the child grows it and harvests it and cooks with it, it's a 100% guarantee that the child is going to eat it. So I know Ann Cooper used to be out on Long Island. She's now
She's in Boulder now.
She's in Boulder, but she does work nationally and internationally, and she's a real school food hero. And I think Eating Well magazine just recognized her as a, you know, just a hero in school food. And what did she do? She had fresh food for kids, and she, you can change someone's palate to really love and appreciate good food. And I, you know, my best friend growing up was Italian, and I know how good these ethnic food, ethnic cooks are. I used to beg to eat at her house. But think about, you know, maybe making a cookbook together where a child, each of the children in the class brings in a recipe from their grandmother, and they can create their own cookbook, and then each child can maybe make that dish in the classroom for their friends, and it's magical.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I want to try to, you know, use some of these resources, and yeah, there's so much that can be done. It's really exciting. Linda, let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about Food Sleuth Radio and what you're doing on your radio show and how you're reaching people and changing how people think about food system literacy. So everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Melinda Himmelgarn as my guest. Be right back.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and I'm the host of What Women Must Know every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. As a naturopathic doctor and psychotherapist, I am always seeking the latest solutions to help you rejuvenate and regenerate your body, mind, and spirit. So join me, Dr. Cheryl, and my inspiring guests, authors, health practitioners, and wise elders to empower yourself by expanding your knowledge about your health and your hormones and to gain fresh new perspectives on life. That's What Women Must Know every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, my guest today is Melinda Himmelgarn. She's a dietitian and radio host of Food Sleuth Radio and an investigative nutritionist. And we're talking about, we're just getting ready to talk about her radio show, Food Sleuth Radio. So, Melinda, can you tell us when did you start your radio show, and what is your main focus of your radio show?
So, the radio program really came about quite by accident. I had been writing a newspaper column for 20 years, as you mentioned in the intro, and like many newspapers, my local newspaper decided that it was going to shrink, and newspapers across the country have done this. They've let go of many of their staff. I actually was a freelancer. I contributed a column. But I just ran into the general manager of our community radio station, and he said, "Do you want to do a radio program?" And I was like, "Yes, I would." I had done a lot of media at the University of Missouri when I was there, and I felt very comfortable with the medium. In fact, I probably feel the same way, but radio is so intimate. And I truly love talking to people each week. It's a weekly 30-minute interview program. We don't take call-ins. Unfortunately, we're not set up for that. But I try to find guests who can connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And I say find food truth because it is extremely difficult to find the truth. For example, and I'm going to just tell a little side story here because I can't resist commenting on something that you mentioned earlier about GMO wheat and GMOs in general. I am living in the belly of the beast when it comes to genetically modified crops. I live in the Midwest, which is the corn and soy belt. And I don't care what anybody tells you about, oh, how GMO crops are going to feed the world. GMO crops are predominantly designed to be resistant to herbicide sprays, and that's what makes the corporations a lot of money. They patent the seed, so farmers can't save their seed. They have to buy it new every year. And in addition to that, they spray chemicals on it that are, the chemicals are also produced by the same companies that make the seed. It's a great business model. Unfortunately, what we're finding is that we have a lot of herbicide and genetic drift. So if there's an organic farmer, say, living next to a GMO farmer, the organic farmer may indeed be contaminated by drift from genetic drift, from, say, pollen, or from herbicide drift, and that could kill his crops. And there really is very little that organic farmer can do. So these are sides of the story that people on the East Coast and West Coast may not really realize because they're not in the belly of the beast. And so we just hear these messages about how great these things are. Now, I do want to piggyback then on food system literacy. So how this all comes together is that we want to ask critical questions in order to find food truth. So one of the questions we want to ask is, where did my food come from? And who produced it? You know, who owns or profits from the technology that was used? And under what conditions was my food grown or produced? You know, how were the workers treated? How were the animals treated? Were they treated humanely and fairly? We want to know what's on or in our food or not. So are there pesticide residues? Were antibiotics used, you know, in the animals? What about additives? Are there colors that don't really need to be there? And then what are the unintended consequences of my food and farming choices? So if you're living on the East Coast and, you know, you're not really embedded in this corn and soy world, every time you buy processed food, you get a little bit of that corn and soy generally. And if you're buying something that isn't certified organic, chances are you're going to be getting some of the GMO corn and soy in your food. And that impacts the communities in the Midwest that are being drenched in the sprays. So anyway, I've probably answered too long, but that's how it all comes together for me.
Yeah. No, your answer is perfect, because also when I talk about the school food, you know, all those words that are on the labels of these processed foods that you can't understand, the majority of them are derivatives of corn and soy and genetically modified corn and soy, because those
are,
you know, 90 to 95% of our corn and soy is genetically modified. So that's why it's so important that those ingredients really be organic.
Absolutely. So, and people may not realize, you know, people are worried about, you know, well, has organic lost its integrity? Organic, you know, we have to be, as you mentioned earlier, political activists. We need to be awake, and we need to be paying attention always to our food. We can't really ever rest because there is so much interest in making money and taking advantage of people. But organic is the best we've got, and I know you mentioned NOFA, and you've got some great people up in the Northeast, Dave Chapman, for example, who's done a lot to protect the integrity of the organic label. But we have to pay attention to it, and the National Organic Standards Board provides an avenue for consumers to voice concerns to members of that board. And I encourage everyone to do that. But if you're wanting to avoid herbicide residues on your food, and if you're wanting to avoid genetically modified ingredients and all the corporate profit that goes along with those seeds and herbicides, then the recommendation would be to purchase organic food. It is genetically engineered ingredients are not allowed in organic food systems.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I also would recommend, I mean, to the best of your ability, to buy organic that's coming from our country, because I mean, we don't, even in our country, we don't do such a great job at monitoring all the organics as we should. I mean, we do the best that they say they can. But, you know, when it's coming from another country, it's, you know, you don't know how it is. And maybe you know the answer to this. I've asked many people and haven't really gotten a straight answer. But I know when I'm flying in from another country, you're never allowed to bring agricultural products. So when they're bringing in organic anything from another country, do they irradiate it or something to kill the potential bugs that they're concerned about?
Well, I am not an expert in and able to answer that question, but I don't believe irradiation is allowed. But I don't want to speak outside my area of expertise. I would have to check with someone who is in an authoritarian position. So let me just answer that by saying I don't know. I will say, though,
because
that
I haven't gotten a straight answer from anyone on that, because no one seems to really know. When you think about it, they are so concerned about you bringing something in from another country that could infect this country.
I would ask somebody on the NOSB, National Organic Standards Board. Any of those people would be the most up to date on the practices.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the laws. Yeah, that's how, I don't know the answer to every question, but I'm pretty good at finding out people who could answer it. So I would start with the NOSB, and with you serving on the NOFA board, which is fantastic. Klaus Martens up in New York State is brilliant. I served with him on the Organic Farming Research Foundation board. He's a great person to go to. I served on two organic farming boards. It's been a few years now since I've been on the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service Board, but that's where I really learned so much. My two best teachers were my patients that I helped. They helped me in return. They gave me a great lesson. And organic farmers, they're such keen observers, and they really know that they have to follow so many rules and regulations, so they're the ones to check with.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about keen observers, it just made me think of this great documentary I just saw, The Biggest Little Farm. Have you seen that yet?
It is playing in a movie theater near me, and it has been recommended. I haven't seen it
yet. Yeah, really sweet, really sweet. Everyone out there, if you're hearing this show, I recommend it, Biggest Little Farm. It's just, it's all about that observation, moving slow enough to, look at nature to try to find the answers. It's really great, really great.
And we don't reward farmers the way we should either. We don't really reward them on quality of food. We reward them on quantity. And when you're in that system of quantity being what everything matters, you're not going to take the time to be the keen observer. I also want to mention something about, imports. If we were to eat seasonally and preserve our food like we did generations ago, we wouldn't have to, or we wouldn't want to, import produce that isn't in season, say, in January or February. So
right.
it takes looking at how we eat a little bit differently. And I'm the first one to say, I used to buy strawberries in January, but I don't do that anymore. I think there's something good about anticipating food. I can't wait. My strawberries are ripe, and the rhubarb is just about ready to pick in my garden. I can't wait to make a strawberry rhubarb tart. But I don't have strawberry rhubarb tarts in December unless I've frozen strawberries and frozen rhubarb, which I do. But that's how you can harvest now to enjoy on those dark, gloomy winter days.
Right. Or you preserve it yourself, like you were talking about preserving. It's like I might, get all my blueberries at once and pick a big basket full, and then I freeze them,
Exactly.
And they're great to have frozen in, in the middle of the winter if you want to make a blueberry apple pie, just something
exactly.
to give a little change to your apple.
But keep in mind that assumes that we have access to a freezer that's big enough to hold this food. And that we have the skill set. So getting back to home economists, right, and the College of Home Economics and teaching home economics in schools, in high school, it's really important for people to know these life skills and to be able to earn a living wage so that you can afford to buy, quote-unquote, good food and also be able to afford a freezer or a large enough refrigerator freezer where you can keep things. I just feel like there's too many people living in poverty to be able to practice a lot of what we preach. And I think that we need to think about that very hard. And, as the new election cycle comes up, once again, back to your political activist call, we need to let our legislators know that everyone deserves access to good food.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. And, you know, when I was younger, I didn't recognize how important it was to become an activist. You know, I mean, I would join in a march, but I'm talking about, you know, sitting down, writing those letters and calling my congressman or my governor and, you know, telling them that climate's important to me or GMO regulation is important to me or whatever it is. It's so important.
Right.
You know, another thing I want to ask you, I know, you know, in your bio, you talk about media, art, advertising, and storytelling all being used to influence the way people think about food and food system literacy. Mm-hmm. And in today's polarization of politics, both media and journalism lean heavily to the right or to the left. Where do you suggest people go to hear an unbiased story, to hear the true food news? Other than your radio show and my radio show.
Well, I do want to make one thing really clear, and that is there is no such thing as unbiased news. As much as you may think, oh, this is, you know, this is objective reporting, there's bias everywhere. And I didn't make this up. I actually learned it. I became very interested in media's impact on children's food choices back when I was working at the university and working with the Missouri Department of Public Health. And I started going to media literacy conferences. And I really found, I guess you could say I found religion, but I found, I had an epiphany in understanding just how much we're manipulated by media. And, of course, everybody thinks that it's not them. It's the other person that's manipulated by media. So even if you've got media literacy training and you teach media literacy courses, I am still influenced by media. It's very complex, you know, how media messages are developed. I can tell you that here at the University of Missouri, we have a world-famous journalism school. And I remember going to different seminars, you know, that they would put on. But there's actually an advertising department where they will put electrodes on people's heads to see which advertisement is going to stimulate the center of the brain that's going to get them to like the product more. I mean, we're talking about really sophisticated techniques used to get us to buy or do something. The mm-hmm. beauty of media literacy is it allows us to step back from the message and ask, who owns the message? Who is their target audience? What do they want us to do? And what are the methods that are being used against us? And it's basically the propaganda playbook. You can go online and you can just look up propaganda playbook. And whether you're talking about a presidential campaign or an ad for a soda, there are certain activities or certain principles that are used to get us to favorably look at a product. Nostalgia is a great example. So nostalgia is used to get us to favorably like a product because we look at the good old days, right? We forget the bad of the past, and we think of the past fondly, generally. And so think about President Trump's campaign, right? Make America Great Again. That was a really brilliant use of nostalgia as a manipulative tool. At the Beyond Pesticide Forum that we had recently where we got to meet in person, I gave a talk on media literacy and pesticides in particular. But another tool to get us to do something or like something in media is when everybody else is doing it. It's called bandwagoning. This happens in farming communities. You know, they don't want to be talked about at the coffee shop. Kids don't want to be talked about in the cafeteria as being a little different. So you go along with the group. And so any ads that make you think that everybody who looks like me is doing something and having fun while doing it, you're going to want to do it too. So it's understanding the strategies. You know, and I recently interviewed a wonderful woman from Toronto, actually. Her name is Andrea Curtis, and she wrote a great little book called Eat This. And it identifies strategies that are used against kids in how to get them to, you know, why do kids want to buy soda? Why do kids say that pizza is their favorite food and yet they want to go to McDonald's? It's because they've been manipulated to using these different strategies. Like having a toy offered with a meal, that's brilliant. For a limited time only, oh my gosh, scarcity, right? Got to go get it right away. So these are all strategies and techniques that I talk about, not only in the food system, but also in agriculture.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, what's really great is if you can wake the young people up to the fact that they're being manipulated, because none of them want to be manipulated. They all think they're so independent and individual, you know, and that they're not bandwagoning, you know, they're, you know, everyone has, you know, their own individual look, yet everybody has the tattoo now, or everybody has the piercing, or, you know, you know, and so, you know, trying to make them see how they're being manipulated so that they get angry about it is a wonderful educational tool.
Yeah, and let me just give you another example, especially with kids, because we really, of course, care about our future, and children are our future. And I often, when I was working with a group of fifth graders, you know, we looked at ads for alcohol and tobacco, and of course, there are less ads for tobacco now than there were back when we were kids. But ads for alcohol, you'll never see anybody drinking alone. You'll always see them having fun with friends. And so you think about, gosh, I want more friends. I want to have a good time. I guess I need this product to get there. And so that's another tool that's used against us. Another one is scientific support. So years ago, you know, you'd see a doctor recommending a certain tobacco brand, if you can believe it. But now we have, like, all of these scientists supporting genetically modified seeds. And do we really? No, there's actually a large and growing number of scientists who don't support the technology because of the unintended consequences. However, if you look at the advertising for genetic engineering and for, you know, using these different herbicides, you'll see how science is used. You know, this is what the white lab coat scientist is recommending.
Right. And again, if you follow the money, so many of those scientists are in cahoots. They have some investment. They're making money on that. It's just really, you know, amazing if you really follow the money almost in anything. You can really get to some of the truth. Melinda, I can't believe it. We're almost out of time. So I was hoping you could share with everybody how they could get in touch with you, how they can hear your radio show if they don't live in Missouri.
If you go to Food Sleuth Radio, and that's sleuth like detective, it's the worst word to either pronounce or spell. It's S as in Sam, L-E-U-T-H. If you Google Food Sleuth Radio, it's available it's available as a radio program on about 50 stations nationwide, but it's also available via podcast. So it's on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes. You can go to kopn.org. We air every Thursday at 5. At kopn.org, and that's 5 Central Time. And then the shows are also available on Public Radio Exchange. So you can hear archive shows on KOPN, you can kopn.org, or you can also go to Public Radio Exchange, or your favorite podcast app will also have them available. And thank you very much for having me on the program and offering to let me help promote the program. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been so nice to have this conversation with you. The work you're doing is so important. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. And have a great rest of the week. And I'll be with you all again next week. Bye for now.